1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame takes affirmative action to induct Yes.
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
And I think that was a good thing about the Yes group, that it would never take no for an answer.
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
Isn't that a good line?
The first two albums were obviously not successful, even in England. It was fortunately, it was a time where you could go through three albums and the record company kind of let you go on.
I was always convinced, and it sounds a bit egotistical, but I don't mean it to. I was always convinced that when we did Fragile, all the time that we were recording it, writing it, and putting it together, that it was something very, very special.
Probably around Fragile was the time that I started to become a little bit more like a director. They used to call me Napoleon. They never told me to my face. It didn't matter, you know. I didn't care as long as, you know, it was happening. Later, I learned the word catalyst.
Long distance, gone around.
Close to the end, down by a river. Seasons will pass you by. Get up, get down.
I think there was a unified feeling about doing Close to the Edge that was a moment in time. It never happened again and never will happen again the way that happened. It was a collective knowledge that we were embarking on something a little bit new, a little bit uncharted territory. And I think that's one of the things that make Close to the Edge as perennial as it is. Hello, this is John Anderson of Yes.
Hi, this is Rick Wakeman of Yes.
Hello, this is Bill Bruford of Yes.
And this is Steve Howe of Yes, and you're in the studio for the 1972 Close to the Edge experience.
Of all the bands that came to the forefront in the progressive rock movement of the early 1970s, none found more critical and commercial success than Yes. A number of bands, including King Crimson and Genesis, like Yes, based in London, were incorporating jazz and classical influences into rock, creating complex pieces of music while experimenting with new, often electronic sounds then. What distinguished Yes from other progressive rock bands back then was that the grandeur of the music never obscured the melody of the song. John Anderson's unmistakably high, clear singing voice and bassist Chris Squire's harmonies gave Yes a focal point and a lyrical framework strong enough to support the band's dazzling musicianship. John Anderson remembers that he and Chris Squire lucked out, getting a world-class, technically proficient drummer from a tiny newspaper ad.
Bill Bruford, he was advertising in The Melody Maker, and it's a very sort of typical story. I rang him up. Me and Chris rang him and said, you play drums? And he said, yeah, I'm a good drummer. So the only way we knew which was a good drummer was if he had a Ludwig kit, if he had a drum kit called Ludwig. So we said, do you play Ludwig? And he said, yeah, of course I do. And I think what he did, he quickly sprayed his sonar kit black to look like a Ludwig, you see. So when he came to do a sort of a audition, if you like, it looked like a Ludwig kit, but he was a good player, you see, so that worked pretty well. And he had a car, which helped. I mean, it was only a Mini, it was a very small car. He said it was his, actually, it was a girlfriend of his, but then he was in the group, right? He was in the group before we met him. And then we got Tony Kaye, very groovy guy. I'd met Tony 4 years before in Leicester, or was it Manchester? So we sort of knew each other, and and Pete Banks was there, and he was already with Chris in a group called Mabel Greer's Toy Shop. So the first thing I said to Chris was, maybe we should change the name.
Original Yes keyboard player Tony Kaye points out that prior to this third album, their recording company was encouraging Yes to cover outside songwriters, including Paul Simon's America, just trying to get them a hit single.
For instance, at the beginning, we did covers of other people's songs, like the Beatles thing and the Crosby, Stills and Nash thing, and a couple of other America and that kind of stuff. And we just put it into a different musical ballpark, really, and embellished it and made it more symphonic and more instrumental. And the first two albums didn't really reflect, you know, what was coming. It was like the start of the way that we were thinking. And up until the Yes album, it was just kind of trying to do, you know, something different, really, and playing to English audiences who, in a way, for most part, was pretty much of an uphill battle. It was really start of another era where bands, you know, like the Nice and early Genesis were really trying to do something different. I guess we were trying to catch on to something that we really didn't know what it was going to be, but we wanted to push it in another direction. And the first two albums were obviously not successful, even in England. It was fortunately it was a time where you could go through three albums, and the record company kind of let you go on.
I was very lucky because when I first started working with Chris and Tony and Peter and Bill, there was definitely a feeling that we were all experimenting. It was a very, very great time in London for experimenting around 68, 69. The five major bands that came out of that time were King Crimson, ELP, Yes, Zeppelin, Deep Purple. These were groups of people that, unbeknown to themselves, were doing very, very similar activity. It was like nobody really knew what each other groups were doing. It just happens that around that period of time, everybody was sort of setting the sort of stall, the sort of theater for the early 70s kind of music, which in a way came over from England to America. In 68, we were sort of the local band in London that was spoken about very well. And then we went to the speakeasy one night and we heard this band was playing called King Crimson. And we said, okay, well, let's check them out, see how good they are. And they were great. They seriously were great. And we all sort of, big gloom, you know, we had a big cloud over us for about a week trying to get over the fact that they were better than us, you know, or more ingenuitive. You know, I mean, they were more, very similar attitude to music, but more organized. And that pushed the group on, you know, it made them work harder. And when we saw Mahavishnu, it made the band work harder. And I think that was a good thing about the Yes group. It would never take no for an answer. Isn't that a good line?
John Anderson is quick to credit bass player and harmony singer Chris Squire, who passed away recently, for the Yes sound as much as anyone.
A lot of the musical things over the years would have gone too light. But for Chris, Chris sort of brings it back down to earth because of his Pisces, and he has that sort of earth, water energy, you know. It does take a long time to get things coordinated in his mind, but I think that's a very good sort of situation because I tend to just fly away like crazy. I come up with ideas like very fast. But it's always been, in a way, a little battle between me and Chris as to how it all finishes up, how it all turns out. Me with a zillion ideas and him with a more decisive point of view.
And in turn, the late Chris Squire points to the original Yes drummer, Bill Bruford, for whipping the band into shape.
I must say, a lot of it was down to the energy of Bill Bruford, because initially, any band is only as active and creative and as good as its drummer. That's where it all starts. And he kind of like was a very much a driving force in that period. that influence on Yes was a very good one. He was a particularly good influence on me.
Original Yes drummer, Bill Bruford.
Usually, he presented them with a great deal of vigor, a great deal of muscle, and a great deal of, if you don't like it, think of something better. That's usually was John's approach. So he would play something really horrendously terrible. And most people would say, oh, do we have to play this? Oh, no. Well, all right, if we've got to, why don't you put the sixth there in the chord and play it like that? And then somebody would say, yeah, but if you put an F in the bass instead of the G root, then it'll sound better. And you see what happens. The original idea would become turned into music by the four competent musicians around him. So he would bang out some horrendous, god-awful noise over one chord, getting his fingers caught in the strings, with a look in his eyes which said, if you don't like this, quit or make it better. Which is a technique, you know, that Hitler would use. Somewhere slightly to the right of Hitler. And of course, people would say, oh, you know, do I have to leave the group? No. All right, well, let's tell him that if you move the G6 to the G-6, then it'll sound really good, you know. And so that's what would happen. And then somebody would say, well, that sounds quite good. And hey presto, the ball is up and running. Often used by band leaders in some way or another. It's throwing down a gauntlet saying, I'm doing this. If you guys can like it, or you can leave it, or you can improve it. So we'd improve it.
Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with John Anderson, Rick Wakeman, Bill Bruford, Tony Kaye, Steve Howe, and the late Yes co-founder Chris Squire for Ultimate Yes Part 1.
Hi, this is John Anderson, and you're in the studio for Fragile.
Hello, this is Bill Bruford of Yes.
And this is Steve Howe of Yes, and you're in the studio.
Hi, this is Tony Kaye, and you're in the studio.
Hello, this is Rick Wakeman, in the studio for Fragile, with Redbeard.
Thanks again, guys. Yes lead singer John Anderson comments on their first addition to the original lineup after the departure of guitarist Banks.
When Steve Howe joined the group, it made us more musical. Our scope was more musical. Peter Banks, very good guitar player, but his scope was sort of limited at times. Where when Steve came in, we had all this sort of Baroque attitude to music and some very classical trained attitude to music, country and western. Steve could really jump from one thing to another very fast, very talented man. I actually saw him a month before we actually got together, and I went to the speakeasy, and he was playing. And I remember walking right past him underneath the stage and just looking at this guy with this beautiful guitar playing so many notes and so clear, singing away with his guitar. And I remembered that I thought he was very, very, you know, very clear in his style. And then his name came up a month later and I said, well, if he'll join, let's go for it. And he did join. It was definitely a good move for him. It was a good move for the group. He enjoyed himself immensely. And obviously, when you're happy, your music gets better. And he got better and better within that first couple of months of rehearsal. Me and Steve became very close. We had very similar attitudes to making music. So we'd sit down and write songs without any effort. And music actually is effortless. The more clear the combination of people. It isn't hard to make music. That's the fact. And we really enjoyed recording the Yes album. It didn't take too long. What we really wanted to do was to get on the road and show this new guy off, you know?
Original Yes keyboard player, Tony Kaye.
I was probably one of the first people in the band to have heard Steve. Yes, he was playing in a band that used to play at a club that I used to frequent very often. I think it was called Bodast, and it was mainly it wasn't that progressive. It was mainly a rock and roll band. I saw Steve play, and I thought, this guy's really got something else. But he was playing in a band that was really quite a raunchy rock and roll band, which is something that I kind of wanted for the band at that time. As soon as he came into the band, he went into a different mode and started playing much more progressive guitar than this kind of raunchy player that I remembered. So it was kind of strange. Although for the Yes album, it was fine, but on from that, probably for me, it was it was too, the conflict between keyboards and guitar was too much of a conflict, really. Although that was the direction that Yes was going, a lot of notes. And although the Yes album turned really to be quite a simple album in many respects, considering where Yes went on to from there.
For many people, critics and fans alike, the essence of rock and roll has always been its simplicity, its rebelliousness, its pure, raw, adolescent energy. But as the 1970s began, there were others who believed it was possible to broaden the scope of rock and roll without diluting its power or its energy. They were serious musicians, often classically trained, who saw rock and roll as a means of serious artistic expression, a true art form. The problem, and it still exists today, was that many of these so-called art rock bands believed that serious music and mainstream popularity were basically incompatible, that any band who sold millions of records must have compromised their music to do it. But in 1972, Yes released an album that sold millions of copies without a hint of artistic compromise. It was filled with bold instrumental experiments, classical arrangements, and unusual rhythms. It was a delicate balance of diverse sounds and styles, and perhaps that's why they called it Fragile. Yes released Fragile January 4, 1972. It was the first Yes album to include keyboard player Rick Wakeman, who was the final ingredient in the delicious mixture that was the classic Yes sound. Here's keyboard player Rick Wakeman in the studio.
I'd started doing sessions from playing for different people, and I was interested in the new electronics of instruments that were coming out, although there was only things like the Minimoog and the Mellotron available, really, that was all. But I was desperate to try and improve the relationship of the keyboard within a band, because it was always before the organ that rarely got heard anyway. And I just really thought there was a tremendous future for it, and I was interested in it. And I sort of poked my nose in a bit, and I realised that there was a gap. But the problem I also realised was that if I finished my course for another year, I wouldn't be able to put a full-time thing into what I wanted to do, which was help develop keyboards and bring those to part of the music. But if I didn't, somebody else would. I was very well aware that the course of musical history was not going to be changed by me, but I could be part of it if I wanted to be. So I went to see my father, and I said, I'm quitting college. And my mother just freaked my mum out.
I think we were always into sort of uplifting music. You know, I personally didn't follow the Stones into their satanic realm. I followed the Beatles into All You Need Is Love. That was my dream. I loved it, and I tended to follow that train of thought. It's something we're sort of driven to write this kind of music, and it's not even soul searching. It's very spirited music in many ways, and very the love of life, the love and need for understanding, ecology, and in some ways, all you have to do is to put that into musical form, and you become part and parcel of the people. You're with the people. They want to hear their train of thought put into musical form. That's why they come and see a concert. And we need them to affirm that we're doing the right thing. And the word Yes is that affirmation.
I think definitely the Yes theme has always been a hopeful one. I think, you know rather than light and dark, I think we've used dark expressionism in order to show the difference between good and evil, or light and dark, which, you know, whichever way it is. But usually, even if the songs refer to darkness, it's because there's a positive attitude at the end of it, you know.
The 8-minute song Roundabout became an unconventional hit for Yes off of the fourth album, Fragile. Lead singer John Anderson decodes the lyrics for Roundabout.
Roundabout was actually formulated in Scotland. We were traveling through from Aberdeen through to Glasgow, and we'd started the song by the time we were in Aberdeen. Me and Steve were singing it in the back of the van on the way down. And one of the things that you'll drive through is a very winding small road that goes through this incredible valley, and the mountains are sheer from both sides of the road. They just climb up to the sky. And because it was a cloudy day, we couldn't see the top of the mountains. We could only see the clouds, because it went sheer straight up. and we were just driving down this incredible valley. And I remember saying, oh, the Mariners, look, they're coming out of the sky, you know. So we wrote that down, the Mariners come out of the sky and they stand there, you know. And then we came to a roundabout right at the bottom of this road. And within 24 hours, we would be back in London. We'd been on tour then for about a month. So it was sort of 24 hours before I'll be home with my loved one, Jennifer. So the idea was 24 before my love, I'll be there with you in and around the lake. Just before you get to Glasgow, there's a lake, a very famous one, the Loch Ness. So we were driving in and around the lake. Mariners come out of the sky, they stand there. What we always tried to make sure we wanted was a lot of harmony. Me, Steve and Chris singing together had a certain texture, and we worked on that all the way through that period of time. And the strong melody, sometimes very, very simple. The end of Roundabout, we sing da 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 da. Very simple melody, repeated 8 times. Over that, there's another melody. Ba ba ba, ba ba ba, 3 blind mice, 3 blind mice. So, the way it was put and where it was positioned, it sounds really like, wow, that's really interesting. But I knew it was 3 blind mice, and when we did it, I didn't mind. I just knew that where we put it made it sound totally different, you know?
After the release of the Yes album in 1971, Yes toured America for the first time, opening for Jethro Tull. It was on that tour that the band realized there was a significant audience that was receptive to their brand of complex, densely orchestrated music. John Anderson of Yes.
We did an American tour that really energized us incredibly. We really wanted to get back in the studio and make another album quickly because we knew that we were on a sort of a roll on many levels. And then all of a sudden, there was this definite feeling of, well, we've got Steve and he's very multi-talented. Maybe we should look for a more multi-talented keyboard player. And that's when Rick Wakeman joined the group, who was the sort of darling of the university colleges. He was the man to go and see because he was very talented, very individual in his style. And we actually did a concert with the group he was playing with. The group was called the Strobes. And we did a concert and I watched him. And I saw a really great talent playing away, very young, and he joined the group. So again, we were really injected with that energy again, and that came out in Fragile.
Rick Wakeman was a well-known session keyboard player before he joined the Straubs, working with David Bowie. That's Wakeman on Mellotron on Space Oddity. Wakeman recalls what his life was like in 1971 when he was invited to join the band Yes.
I had a small house, struggling to pay the mortgage, all the usual things, and I decided that I was going to leave and go back to sessions because at least doing the sessions I could make a living. I didn't want to, but that was the situation. And I got a phone call from Chris Squire, which was about June or July of 1971. They just returned from an American tour, their very first tour. They were going to have a few changes, and they decided that they wanted to have a whole new direction in their music. You know, they were after the sort of a continuing of direction in the orchestral rock vein. And to cut a very long story short, we ended up having a rehearsal together, and we ended up writing in the first week Heart of the Sunrise and Roundabout, which just completely freaked me out. I mean, I came back really excited because I felt that here was something that if this didn't capture people's imaginations, then it really was back to sessions. The great thing was that nobody really had come out of college or music school and gone into this side of music before, and if they had, it was into the sort of the session world where they played their notes and that's all they did. Where I suddenly found that I had a part to play was because a lot of music writers had the basic songs and their chords and their various things, but they were limited to the amount of chords that they knew. They were limited to the amount of musical knowledge they had. And they were, in other words, it limited them to what they could do with their song. In other words, they had a great sketch, but they might have only had red and green to play with in their paint pot. And what they found by dragging old Muggins in here was that I didn't have the sketch, but I had a paint pot with all the colours in it. Yeah. So I could turn around and say, look, you need to do this here. You could change that chord sequence there. That'll be much better. And you do that. And you became almost a rock and roll orchestrator. we were convinced that music, musicians of the so-called rock age, or some of them at least, should be taken seriously. That's what we wanted it to do. Of course, we wanted to make commercial, viable records, and we wanted to, people to buy them and enjoy them. We were convinced very much that we wanted to change things, the attitude that there was two sorts of music, the one that you made the pop record that sold millions of copies, and then there was the other musician who, the underground musician, which was very much for people who wanted to discover music, but it wasn't out to the people. It wasn't available for everybody, really. It was something that you almost kept to yourself and took home, that sold. It was almost a bigger success if it sold 18 copies rather than 18 million copies. You know, hey, this album just sold 8 copies. Oh, wow, this must be really good, really good.
That's pretty funny. The Rock Writers loved Fragile by Yes. It still earns 5 stars from the All Music Guide. And with an edit of Roundabout, a surprise number 13 hit in America in 1972, the Yes Band returned to America as headliners. Again, Rick Wakeman.
The record company had no idea what we were doing. And because they had no idea what we were doing, they left us alone. We knew 80% what we were doing, but 20% we didn't know what we were doing. And there weren't all the wonderful effects and things flying around then. So what you did, you experimented wildly and trying to do things, and tracks came together, and there was all the merging of different ideas. And when that appeared, it freaked the record company and a lot of people out, because it was just sort of almost over the top. It was just broke all the rules in long pieces and different sorts of moods within pieces, very complex and things.
That 1972 U.S. tour was a triumph for Yes, and in particular for Wakeman, who soon emerged as one of the first superstar rock keyboard players, a spectacular figure on stage, with his colorful capes and mane of long blonde hair, surrounded by stacks and stacks of electronic keyboards and amplifiers.
It was a marvelous period of time because everybody within the band had great ideas of things that they wanted to do, and also were tremendously supportive. I'd always dreamed of putting more than 2 or 3 keyboards on the stage, of putting like 6 at least around and piling them on top of each other. And nobody had ever done it. And also there was the problem because nobody knew how to monitor it. Nobody knew how to do anything. And the great thing was that all the guys said, go for it. I said, look, there's going to be problems. There was no little mixing, no mixing desk or anything for keyboards and whatever. I said, it was literally having different amps set up. I mean, I had about 7 or 8 Fender amps, you know, for each different instrument. What we were convinced was that you could make a sort of music that was in the underground tradition, but you could do it and present it in a way that it was available for everybody to enjoy, or not enjoy, as the case may be. And that's really what we set out to do. We wanted it to be promoted as if you were promoting a pop album, but saying, but hold on a minute, we want all your promotional aspects and all the things, and we want to go out and play, and we want to put on an outrageous show, but we also want to be recognised that this hopefully is music that won't be forgotten like the normal pop music in a month's time, 6 months' time, or a year's time, or the odd track might just get pulled off. But what we would really like to happen is that in 20 years' time, that a jock on the radio somewhere could pull a track off and play it, and it would not sound out of place.
Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with John Anderson, Rick Wakeman, Bill Bruford, Tony Kaye, Steve Howe, and the late Yes co-founder Chris Squire for Ultimate Yes Part 1.
Hello, this is John Anderson of Yes.
This is Rick Wakeman of Yes.
Hello, this is Bill Bruford of Yes.
And this is Steve Howe of Yes, and you're in the studio for the 1972 Close to the Edge experience with Redbeard.
Remember now, Yes didn't score their musical arrangements ahead of time. Instead, Chris Squire on bass, John Anderson the singer, Steve Howe on guitar, Rick Wakeman on keyboard, and Bill Bruford the drummer would sit around in the practice hall banging it out one chord at a time. Drummer Bill Bruford.
What should astound you is the sheer lunacy of trying to attempt such a thing. And if, of course, we'd known how horrible it was going to be, we would never have done it. But it's like 5 guys trying to write a novel at the same time. You know, one guy has a good beginning, and the second guy has quite a good middle, and the third guy thinks he knows what the ending is, but the fourth guy doesn't like the middle, and he doesn't like the way the middle goes towards the ending. And the second guy, who used to like the third section, has changed his mind and now likes the first section. You see what I mean? It's obviously a nightmare. And very sensibly, people now don't have the time or inclination to work at music that way. So it was a very unusual way to do it.
Yes, lead singer John Anderson, followed by keyboard player Rick Wakeman.
we were making music and we'd stop when it was finished, look at each other and say, well, that's great. What is it? And they'll say, it's 12 minutes long. Wow. Well, we'll just tighten that up a bit. And, you know, hey, it's 10 minutes long. Wow. We were more surprised than anybody that it was long. We just made music until it was finished.
So I can play you lots of music from that era that's 10 minutes long from other people and things, a pile of junk. You know, I can play you 3-minute pieces of music that are piles of junk. What counts is a piece of music that counts for every minute that it's there.
Yeah. You let it happen.
We never timed anything, as John said, at the end of it. How long was that? And Eddie might go, well, that's 6.5 minutes and you're only at the end of the first verse.
Yes, guitarist Steve Howe.
But I remember the sort of chaos that we were in within you and I. We had this song before we knew what happened after da 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 da, you know, three of those. It was like going somewhere and we were all going, but where? And I remember we had, you know, like, amen, amen. We had this two chords at the end. And the idea was that the first chord was just going to go on for an indefinite sort of vanilla fudge sort of length, you know, where you're just going to like hold this chord and everybody was going to boogie on one chord, man, you know, groove on a chord, you know. There's no rhythm. It's just, and so it got to be like, these people were trying to sustain this note and keyboards were hammering this note and Bill was most probably hitting something. And then eventually, like with great relief, it went, you know. And we listened to this a few times and kind of, well, that's great ending. It's a good ending. It's not a bad ending. It's an average ending. It's a pretty lousy ending. So gradually its popularity diminished, you know. And John and I went out there with voice and guitar and sort of did a sort of a shape for an ending. We didn't have an end. So in a way, we were. It was almost the blind leading the blind. But this thing, as Bill said, the fact that we didn't know how good what we were doing was is almost what enabled us to be very progressive, very explorative. It made it more exciting because we were all so stupid in those days. We were all so, you know, I was going to say dumb, but I don't know how you'd explain
green.
It. We were just green, that's it. We say in England, green, wet behind the ears. We didn't know what we were doing, and this was the marvellous expedition that we were on.
It was torture. None of us, these arrangements weren't written, and they weren't really composed, so that we all sat in a rehearsal room and said, well, let's have a G after the G sharp. And every instrument was up for a democratic election, you know, and everybody had to run an election campaign on every issue. And it was horrible. I mean, it was incredibly unpleasant and unbelievably hard work. And Squire was always late, of course, to every rehearsal. And after about, what, 2 months of this?
Yeah, months.
I mean, months.
Used to do this for months. It's punishment.
It was unbelievable punishment. And people say to me, Bill, why, you know, didn't you do another one? I mean, do you understand why I didn't do another one? I wasn't going to go through that again. It was horrible. It was torture.
I think there was a unified feeling about doing Close to the Edge that was a moment in time. It never happened again and never will happen again the way that happened. It was the weather, it was London, it was AdVision Studios, it was the atmosphere. It was a collective knowledge that we were embarking on something a little bit new, a little bit uncharted territory. And I think that's one of the things that make Close to the Edge as perennial as it is.
Details on the induction of Yes into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame coming up in part two with Trevor Rabin and Alan White joining us. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking all of my guests in Yes, past and present, and more in part two. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.